I want to move by both Meekness and Wheatless Day. This not be my home, I don't think I could stay. When I drive on flower, I need not a glad song. If you feed me cornbread, I just can't stick around long. But I never planned, baby, now I'm gonna get a sudden relief. Now, plan now, we're gonna get a set more. Gonna get that tired and we'll be selling tea. Hit me to your back, mama, try me like a mule. Hit me to your back and try me like a mule. I'm going home with the sugar, I ain't much hard to be through.
It may be scratchy, but it's a fine tune. That's the Rabbit Foot Blues from Blind Lemon Jefferson off of a release called King of the Country Blues. Before Blind Lemon, we heard from Ma Rainey off of a Yazoo collection called Black Bottom. That was the Black Eye Blues from Ma Rainey. For people with Alzheimer's disease or dementia, the loss of driving can signal a loss of independence, but it's important not to ignore the risks associated with driving. The American Academy of Neurology has issued a new guideline to help determine when people with Alzheimer's or dementia should stop driving. The guideline advises caregivers to watch for warning signs, which include crashes, traffic tickets, avoiding driving at night or in the rain, and an aggressive or impulsive personality. While these examples may help assess whether a loved one with even mild dementia is unable to drive, a doctor should be consulted. Caregivers should also be aware that their state's driving laws. To learn more about driving risks with dementia or to find a neurologist near you, visit the American Academy of Neurology's website for patients and caregivers at aan.com. That is aan.com. Let's hear next from Blind Willie McTell. Here he is with the Atlanta Strut. Blind Willie here on the Deep Blues Hour.
I was going down Merritt Avenue the other night. Met up with a gang of stags. Samuel, come on, go with me down to the Atlanta Strut tonight. Well, I don't care to go. Showed me a quart of corn. Went on down the street. Met up with a little girl. She looked like a lump of Lord have mercy. Me and her walked on down the street like this. I had to go upstairs, you know, went upstairs like this. There was a fella up there. From Maline to a slow down gravy. Get away, whip to that Malin. Another fellow played that bass violin. He could really cheat it. Get away, he played it. Another fellow up there teased a cornet. He got rid of tea, that kind of, but he didn't tease it enough. Another fella played a slide. I liked that slide, I like lost my hair. Get away, play that slide. Thomas says, come on, Samuel. Let me show you how to make this train go out of Atlanta to Augusta on the piano. He started all like this. complaint about them chickens. They just had enough. Cackleberries had enough. By that time, I heard someone stealing the chickens. They had out there in the end. I heard the hen cackle like this. Heard a rooster crow one time. Sing a song for a go. Told I didn't know anything, but I would sing this. Started off on this, I had to go. Went up on the Kennesaw Mountain, gave my horn a blow. Prettiest girl on that ladder, come stepping up to my door. Hugged me and she kissed me, called me sugar lump. Throwed them sweet arms around me like the grapevine around a stump. Shaking, then I had to go.
Now she used to be mine. this joke can't keep a shit on me, no good no how. See me coming out with your man outdoor. When you see me coming out with your man outdoor, I know, stranger, baby, I've been here before. Sun rose that morning, I was laying out on my floor. Sun rose this morning, I was laying out on my floor. No sweet woman to love me, I didn't have no place to go. Let the sun go down now, black dog caught me, yeah. Sun go down now, black dog caught me, yeah. Got nobody to love me, nobody for to feel my care.
Another fine pre-war tune there from Mississippi Bracey. That was The Cherry Ball, recorded 1930. You can find that on a Yazoo release called Lonesome Road Blues. Before Mississippi Bracey, we heard from Arthur Pettis. Same era. That's off of a disc called Jackson Blues. That was the two-time blues from Arthur Pettis. Up next, let's hear from Tampa Red on his bottleneck guitar. This is You Gotta Reap What You Sow. Mr. Tampa Red here on the Deep Blues Hour.
mind don't change. Won't be back, no.
What do you think I'll be able to take my life? You think I'm telling you a story? I ain't never been gonna be able to afford to be. Now you think that's a lie? Nobody knows it, don't you? I just got through playing John Henry, and he was a railroad man, and Casey Jones, he was an engineer. That's a railroad man, that's the same. One was driving the engine, and the other was a steel driver.
Crying. Mama
my mama, we can't keep from crying. My daddy got killed on that serving line, on that serving line. Kill my father on the first degree. Said, children, won't you just hold your breath? We're gonna draw another team from your father there. Your father there. Now, if you want to go to heaven when you're DIE, put on your collar and a TIE. Want to scare a rabbit out of LOG? Just make a little stunt like a DOG. I'm on the road again. Just make a little stunt like a DOG. Mama, mama, won't you look at sis standing in the backyard doing a twist. You better come in here, you dirty wench. You ought to be church at the mourner's bank. At the mourner's bank.
Mr. Furry Lewis there. That was Casey Jones, recording May 1969 on a disc called Fourth and Beale from Furry Lewis down in Memphis there. We also heard from Teddy Williams, recorded in Mississippi in the 1960s. That was the Down Home Blues from Teddy Williams. We're going to hear from Blind Mississippi Morris, also from Memphis. But first, let's check out some Sleepy John Estes from West Tennessee, Jackson, Ripley area, Brownsville, actually. Anyways, Sleepy John Estes here. He's joining us with the Denmark Blues here on the Deep Blues Hour on WRCT, Pittsburgh.
In Denmark, tell you what you do. Let Carl get it, touch you. It's a good place to go. It's a fine place to go. It's a good place to go. Been that long time ago. Now you know Carl, this kind of man. Do what you say, he won't make you ashamed. It's a good place. It's a good place to go. It's a good place to go. I've been there a long time ago. He told me walk right in, have a seat. He got cold rain, but there ain't nothing to eat. It's a good place to go. Now fine place. It's a good place to go. Ought to have been there a long time ago. I met Carl down on Denmark Street. He said, come down to the studio and play for me. It's a good place to go. It's a fine place. It's a good place to go. I've been now a long time, love. Let's be. See Carl in the mall. I want him in the city night. I paid in the middle slow. It's a good place to go. It's a fine place. It's a good place to go. Ought to been not a long time ago. Take a next.
Thank you. time. And call my dad a cherry picker, 'cause he likes his women young and tired.
For the One World Community Radio Program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU, Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP, Brookville, LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT, Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 FM WVCR, Loudonville, Siena College, 98.1 and 105.9 FM WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
One World Radio Program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Makhwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts, Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
WRHU Hempstead, Radio Hofstra University, 89.5 Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, 88.3 WRCT, Pittsburgh, Radio Carnegie Tech. You're listening to the One World Radio Show. And yeah, we're back and joined by our usual hosts. I'm Cody. As well, joining me in our virtual studios is Mickey Hubert out at WRHU on Long Island. Siveto is also joining us in Bush Radio, and we also have special guest, founder of Bush Radio, Brenda Leonard. How are y'all going this morning and afternoon?
We good. We good in Cape Town, yes, Kusi and myself.
We're fine. It's during the day now. It's around about 20 past 3 in Cape Town, and we have a sun. It's been a while since we had a sun because it's cold.
I was going to say, ever since we started doing this with Kusi because of the seasons, you've always said in the beginning, it's cold in Cape Town. When's that stopping?
We are actually in spring now.
Oh, good. Yeah.
I was going to say, are you slowly defrosting?
Yeah, it's heading into summer in the southern hemisphere. And we are finally heading into fall, which is one of my favorite seasons. I know y'all cannot relate, but I personally love the cold. I do not like when it is above like 30 degrees Celsius or even above like 25. So I am glad it is finally cooling off a little bit here in Pennsylvania.
I would agree with you, Cody. Same here in New York. I like it when it cools down. I know, as we were saying, our friends in Bush can't relate, but our friends at Bush are celebrating a very special milestone, 30 years of Bush Radio, which is the reason why we're gathered here today with Brenda. So Brenda, tell the listeners who might not know all over the world who listen to this program what Bush Radio is and how it first came to be. I know it's a very long-winded history, but just give us a little bit of an overview.
Okay, thank you. So Bush Radio is a community radio station in South Africa, and we're also the first community radio station that started in South Africa. So our slogan is the mother of community radio, because we basically the mother, we led to all the other community radio stations to their existence. So currently in South Africa, we've got 280 community radio stations, and Bush Radio was the first. In terms of our history, in the early 1990s like late 1989, we had a state of emergency. This is before Mandela was released and other political prisoners were released from prison. So 1989, state of emergency. And what it meant, what the state of emergency meant, is that all media, all forms of community media were not allowed to operate. In addition to that, you had state editors, for instance, in the newsrooms, and they would determine what could be published and what could not be published. And a lot of other issues in terms of rights and what you could be done, what you could do and what you can't do. Like I always tell young people here at Bush Radio, when three people stood on a corner, maybe going to a shop, they will be considered an illegal gathering under a state of emergency. So they would be arrested for actually being together. So things like that. But in any case, so it was during this time that the idea of forming Bush Radio actually started. It started with a number of community organizations that fought apartheid, so anti-apartheid organizations, basically coming together and saying, we need to get information out. And we need to get that information out quickly. So we need to start a form of media that can do that. And when they looked around, they said, let's start a radio station, but it must be a community radio station that talks in our accents and talks about our issues. And at that time, there was a term they used, bread and butter issues. And that means the local issues, whether your streets are swept, the electricity campaigns and things like that, that they wanted to see and hear about in the media. So fast forward 2 years later to 1991, Bush Radio was then established. We applied for a license to the apartheid government, because even though it was 1991, the apartheid government was in existence until 1994. So we applied for license. They then refused. We applied again. They refused. And in 1993, at the beginning of the year, we said, listen, the laws of this government doesn't affect us. We don't have to adhere to those laws because we didn't vote for this government. And because of that, we do not recognize the broadcast laws. So even though we applied for license twice and it was refused, we are going to basically broadcast without their permission. And we did a pirate broadcast for 4 hours. And the next day, the post office, which is the institution that normally issued the license, as well as the security police, came to our station, our premises, and they confiscated the transmitter. They arrested two people at that time and basically took them through the court system. They arrested them, charged them, and then they had to go to court. The court case went on for a year. And after that year, it was kicked out because by that time, we were just about going into elections. And it was then decided, let's kick the case out because there's sort of interim legislation in place to establish community radio after the elections. So this is 1994. Bush Radio then got its transmitter back and the case was dropped and everything. And then after our elections, which happened on the 27th of April, 1994, this is the first democratic elections in South Africa. After that, the broadcast authority basically asked community radio stations to apply for licenses, and Bush Radio applied, and we got a license in 1995. So that's a very short history. There's a lot of other things, but I'll stop there.
Brenda, what took me most with your story was how you were saying the government wouldn't give you the license or you weren't following that government's rules, but you still went ahead and did it anyway and did the pirate broadcast because you believed so much in what you were doing. How did you all muster up the courage to do that and stand up to this government? Because that's very inspiring and very courageous.
During that time and even during apartheid, there was a lot of activism that happened. So people opposed the government. And if you understood the apartheid government in its entirety, you had to understand that you needed to fight the government at all levels. So whether you fight the government, so media shapes the minds of people. And it was very important that that's also seen as a terrain of struggle that was called that time. So to mobilize the people, it was a lot of anti-apartheid organizations that came together to established bush radio, and those people were all activists, all actively fighting the apartheid government in their field. So some of it were workers' organizations like trade unions, some of it were children's rights organizations, some of it were sports bodies, cultural bodies, cultural groups, etc. It was all people who were disenfranchised by the apartheid government. So just getting that together, it was easier. I think the most difficult thing was very few people actually knew what radio was, because we never had access to actually go into a studio as Black South Africans and go and learn about what radio and how to produce radio and how to structure program schedule or any of those things. We've never done that. And that was one of the difficult areas. And the second one was, it was actually illegal in South Africa to own a transmitter. And you need a transmitter to broadcast. So an interesting story, how we got the transmitter, it was actually sent through the diplomatic pouch from Germany. We had a funder called Friedrich Ebert Stifting. I can't remember the English translation, but it's a FES media. They still exist today. And they actually, through contacts in the embassies, send the transmitter in parts through a diplomatic pouch, in a diplomatic pouch. And we received it. And we had to ask one of the technical universities to actually assemble it, because we had no clue how to assemble this and what it should look like and all of that. Remember, we're talking early 90s, so we couldn't go to like Google or any of those search engines to actually find out how to do it. Yeah, so when we started broadcasting, the transmitter was only allowed on, it was set on one frequency, and that was the only frequency we could use, because that's how it was set up when they put it together.
Something else, Brenda, I know you were saying with the transmitter, but what you were also saying was, now you have your license, democratic elections have happened, and Bush Radio was operating. You said people didn't know much about radio, just as in general. So how do you build up a station from the ground up with people who might not really know about programming and things of that nature? Because obviously you have the transmitter, that's important. But knowing how to run the day-to-day operations is also crucially important. How did you create that for yourselves?
During that time, like early 90s, this is all before the elections. So during that time, part of the transitioning process in South Africa included the returning of exiles. So with the exiles, some of them worked in radio. The Liberation Organization, the ANC, had a radio station in Lusaka, for instance. Some of them worked in like Zimbabwe, national broadcaster, and so on. So they came back into South Africa with skills. And we basically use their knowledge and their skills to train the others on how to do those things, how to operate a mixer, how to structure a program, how to structure a program schedule. Then we also, it was very, Bush Radio is still very community orientated. So the community played a role in content on the station. What do you want to listen to? One. And when do you want to listen to it? Those people had lives there to take a train where they couldn't listen to radio. So we structured the program schedule based on the needs of what people are saying. It was an exciting period during that time, because there was a lot of training and development taking place. I think also we had friends across the world really that came and supported Bush Radio's growth. So I had people in Australia that had community radio for a number of years. We had people in Sweden, for instance, that also had community radio and offered a lot of training that. And then we had Canadians that also has, they were running community radio for a number of years. So the interesting thing is, if you look at community radio, even now today, 30 years later, the structure is sort of a mixture of what you would find in Australia and Canada.
And Brenda, I'm curious, you'd mentioned, you know, did with licensing. What did the media scene look like at that time with the apartheid government? Were there a handful of radio stations? Were there minimal to no radio stations?
During apartheid, you had one form of radio. You had basically public radio only. So there were no community radio and no private radio allowed under the legislation. So that's all you had. And the public radio were completely state controlled. So the state would actually have people in the radio station running that radio station. So that was on the radio side. You had, in terms of newspapers, you had some newspapers that emerged as independent newspapers during that time. Before 1990, we didn't have independent newspapers. We had a few community newspapers, but it would actually be banned as it publishes the newspapers. So you had some newspapers, and we had one television that was also public television. So that's what it looked like. Community radio had a lot of initiatives, and they set up projects across the country emerging from Bush Radio. So when Bush Radio started, because while we were applying for license, what we did is our story was told in the newspaper. And that led to a lot of other projects across the country that had community newsletters or had like a newsletter, yes, not a newspaper. So they would publish that and send it out in the different communities. And they then approached us and said, listen, we want to do the same. We also want to set up a community radio station. And that's how we established like a network of about 10 community radio projects across South Africa at that stage. This is before 1994.
Brenda, I know you were saying about we're talking about media and how you guys were all pioneers. I'm curious to know, why did you guys find that, because you were talking about television stations and newspapers, why did you find that radio was and still is, especially community radio, the way to tackle these bread and butter issues that you were discussing earlier?
I think it's just the nature of what makes radio unique. The one is it's a companion, so you can listen to it while doing other things. Secondly, and I think this was a big motivator, it was cheap to create. The third reason, also a big motivator, it was immediate. So with the state of emergency, sometimes you had to get information out quickly. And you couldn't now go print it, or we didn't have access to television, but you couldn't go print it or put it in a newspaper because it wouldn't be published. So radio was chosen because you can have the information, have a script, go in studio and then put that information out. So that's why it's quick, it's cheap to produce. And then the last reason why, because we wanted to produce something that's multilingual, that doesn't only talk English, but actually talk the languages, the local languages, and can cross the barriers of illiteracy that existed at that time. So people could talk across different languages. You didn't need to be able to read to actually listen to the content. And those were some of the reasons why we decided on radio.
I'm curious about how you experimented with format. Like when we're thinking multilingual broadcasting, oftentimes in Western media, they will do someone speaking in their native language, and then someone will do a voiceover where you actually won't hear the native language being spoken anymore. And that's not necessarily conducive for multiple audiences to be able to understand and comprehend what is going on. I'm curious, like, were you in, say, like, you do a news hour, say, you know, one line and then translating and saying it in different languages, or did you have different hours for different languages?
I'll answer that question in two ways. The one is the news, the last part of the question that you've asked. the way we did news at that time is we will have a bulletin in English and then a bulletin in Isikosa, a bulletin in Afrikaans. I think today we still do that. We do different bulletins in different languages. So when we do headlines on the half an hour, those headlines will also be in the language that the full bulletin will be in. The programming is completely different, though. We, at that time, we had two or three presenters in studio talking different languages. And they will then engage and talk into the different languages. We also, at that stage, would translate something someone said, but not with voiceovers, because we wanted everyone to be there. It's like you having a conversation with your friends and you're not understanding something and somebody just tell you, no, that's what that means. That's how we did it. Today, if we look at Bush Radio today, we actually recruit our staff. They must be able to speak at least two languages so that they can then do that in studio. So someone will do an interview maybe in English or in isiXhosa or Afrikaans, and do a brief. But they don't say, now this is a brief. They will just go over and say, I spoke to Kusi, and this is the highlights of what Kusi was saying. And in that way, then translate the important points of the conversation.
Something else I noted when looking at Bush at an overview is that majority of your staff is volunteer. And as Cody was saying with formatting, I noticed your volunteer of the year this year was the Bush Radio Biker Show. You have all different kinds of programming. And you know, you were just saying about the staff, they have to speak at least two languages. How do you find the volunteers and say, oh, they want to do a show about this? Or do you give them the topics? How does that work so you put together this diverse style of programming that you have at Bush?
Okay. So you're right in terms of the majority of our staff. When we talk about staff, we talk about both paid and our volunteers. But our volunteers are producing 70% of our content. So they are on air basically every day from 7 until the next morning, 6 a.m. And on weekends from 7 p.m. on a Friday up till Monday morning, 6 a.m. The volunteers basically take care of all the evening programming, and we have a small daytime staff. So the way we work is we actually try not to have like one person as a single person doing a show. We want to have teams, and we have teams like the Biker Show. I have a team of people does the show, and we try to encourage that with all the other shows, because that's where you get the language diversity.
So on my side, Brenda, is the question, it's not really a question, but it's a matter of training. So I know that Bush Radio has been in the forefront for training, especially first timers who've been in the media in the K flats. How's that been working out? And I see that also with the children's radio workshop is back again. We're empowering future leaders of the country. But how's that? Why is it the core when it comes to training now?
I think that's something we came when Bush Radio was established. Training was a very key part of what we did. Yes, we were going to start the radio station, but people at that time, we said we need to have access to radio, and that was the legislative part, getting that license. And the second part was using that access. And to be able to use the access properly and responsibly, we needed to train people to be able to do that. So from the establishment of Bush Radio in the early 90s, we've actually done training through the years. And that's been one of the important pillars of what we actually do. So today, we still offer training. We offer training to young journalists, young reporters, but we also offer training to anyone who wants to make radio, to be a radio content producer. We train those people as well. I was smiling when Kusi asked the question, because he's one of our key trainers at the station. And one project that he's always part of is every year in the October, the spring school holidays, it is a Robben Island spring school. And this spring school is on Robben Island, and youth are recruited from various schools, not only in South Africa, but in SADC. And they come together for 1 week on Robben Island, where they trained in different forms of media. So we always do the radio segment, and Kusi's been our trainer there. I can't remember, for the last 5 years, I think, at least, if not more.
And while we're on the topic of Kusi, Kusi, what was your journey like with Bush Radio? What made you want to be a part of it?
Obviously, because of unemployment, but also the love of the radio, and also not understanding what's radio all about. That's where I started learning more about it, you know, using sound to tell stories, especially community stories. Then, but I fell more in love into passing on knowledge, you know, on, you know, giving more of what I've learned, especially when it comes to training, because I enjoy that one, that part of it more.
Just explain how we came into Bush, because I think people have different ways of getting into Bush Radio. And I think he came in through one of the ways. So how did you hear about us recruiting people?
Oh, okay. For me, I heard it on social media. I think social media was the one that I saw it, that you guys were looking for people, and you were looking for a whole lot of people, especially when it comes to if you from the community. And what I liked about it is you guys didn't want any experience, but you wanted to give more training into people who have never heard about radio. So that's how I've heard about it. And then, yeah, man, years later, I'm still here.
10 years later.
Damn.
And you had been listening to Bush Radio for a while then at that point, right?
Yes, I was listening to it. Obviously, in the township, the afternoon drive was big because it was the only radio station that was playing, you know, music in the township. Most of the commercial radio station didn't want to play it. And until other radio stations wanted to be involved in it. So most of the things that are happening in the communities, Bush Radio was one of the first stations to play them or not be scared of. And also with the content, unfiltered, although respectful. So those were one of the fascinating things that attracted me.
Discuss some of the, because I was seeing, when reading about Bush, you've had many partnerships with, you were talking about Crew, your children's program, the schools, HIV and AIDS Education Project, South African Red Cross Society. Discuss some of these partnerships, Brenda, if you could get a little deeper into them and the impact that it has on you all at Bush Radio.
Okay. So I think the partnerships really, even today, are really developed out of a need in the community. So if you talk about, like we had a project called YAR 2000, which was in 2000, it was Youth Against AIDS. So YAA 2000. And that project ran about 4 years. And the reason we started that project was actually because there was a huge increase in HIV and AIDS infections amongst young people. And so when I talk about need and we respond to a need, that's basically how most projects are actually started. And this project then used music, hip-hop music specifically, and used that to educate young people about HIV and AIDS. And we did workshops at schools, did an on-air program, like a weekly or daily on-air program. Then we also did a culmination every year in a concert. And the concert were all local artists, hip-hop artists. And they had to write the music specifically for the concert. And we then produced the CD after that. So that was one project. Our